Welcome to the Scarlet Tavern. Grab a drink, take a seat, and let's begin. Picture this. It's the tail end of the Satanic Panic, and our story's about to reach its dramatic finale. Enter two of the era's most colorful characters. Mike Warnke, the ex-Satanist turned Christian comedian, who spun wild tales of devilish escapades that made for best-selling books and packed auditoriums. And Dr. Thomas Radecki, psychiatrist who saw the shadowy hand of Satan lurking behind every dice roll in Dungeons & Dragons. Both men claim to know the devil's playbook, but as the curtain falls, their own stories unravel faster than a badly cast illusion spell. Buckle up, because it's time to meet the masters of the panic, whose final acts left audiences questioning who the real tricksters were all along. This is Scarlet Tavern. All right, so part four, end of Satanic Panic. Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to be doing this part four, and then we're immediately transitioning into something that moves into the Satanic Panic that the Satanic Panic had a real hold on, which is the West Memphis Three. So that one, we're not sure. It may end up being a two-parter. But it depends on how much we go into discussion with that. So we're just trying to give you the best content possible, the most content possible. So
it's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, and we don't want to short you guys with anything. But yeah, so let's just jump right into it because Mike Warnke is a piece of shit.
Is that the one that you're showing clips of earlier?
Yeah.
He looks fucking creepy.
He looks like a gopher.
Yes.
He looks like a gopher.
He really does.
With his mouth full of nuts.
These nuts?
Yeah. So.
What was that?
These nuts?
Mike Warnke, born in 1946 in Evansville, Indiana, to Alfred and Louise Warnke, experienced a turbulent childhood marked by tragedy. After his family moved to Manchester, Tennessee, where his father opened a truck stop, Warnke's life was upended when his mother died in a car accident in 1955. And his father passed away in 1958, leaving him orphaned at the age of 12. Following his father's death, Warnke lived with various relatives, including two aunts in Sparta, and then with his half-sister and her husband in San Bernardino, California. He graduated from Rim of the World High School in 1965 and briefly attended San Bernardino Valley College before dropping out and, according to his later accounts, becoming involved in Satanism. Now, I would probably be weird if I went to a school that was called Rim of the World High School.
I can only just imagine the jokes made by their rivals. God.
Like, is it? It still exists.
The jokes just write themselves.
Public secondary school in Lake Arrowhead, California. It's at the top of San Bernardino Valley. Huh. It only has 915 students. It's a small school.
Yeah, really.
Especially for California. Yeah. So, well. So, on June 2nd, 1966, Warnke enlisted in the United States Navy as a hospital corpsman and reportedly converted to Christianity during boot camp. Though some sources suggest he had already embraced Christianity prior to his naval service. And this is the other thing that's wrong with him. He's a seaman.
Yeah.
Warnke's military service included a deployment to Vietnam in 69, where he claimed to have been wounded in battle and awarded the Purple Heart. His accounts of his Vietnam experience, however, have varied over time, with conflicting reports on the number and nature of his injuries. Despite these inconsistencies, Warnke returned to the United States in 1970, and while still in the Navy, he began collaborating with evangelist Morris Carullo, leveraging his purported experiences as a former Satanist in charismatic revival meetings. This partnership led to the idea of writing a book about youth involvement in the occult, which was initially to be spearheaded by Carullo, but ultimately became Warnke's breakout work. After receiving an early discharge from the Navy in 1972, for, get this, being a conscientious objector,
late to the game,
to focus on ministry, Warnke parted ways with Carullo and started his own ministry. For those that don't know, somebody that's a conscientious objector is somebody that is in the military but does not believe in war or does not believe in engaging in war.
Most times,
most famous conscientious objector is made the movie about him.
Heartbreak Ridge.
Yes.
Hacksaw Ridge.
Heartbreak Ridge was another great movie. Yes. Clint Eastwood.
But Hacksaw Ridge, that was a conscientious objector.
It's going to bug me. I have to look it up.
He was a conscientious objector, but he actually still served.
Most conscientious objectors, when they declare their status, the military will just kick you out.
Yeah. But he fought to stay in.
He
became one of the biggest heroes of all time.
Desmond Doss.
He became one of the biggest heroes of all time.
Desmond Doss was probably the only heroic and good conscientious objector that I don't just... I'm not going to say names, but if you're a conscientious objector, you should, unless you're being drafted when you declare it, you should not be joining the military. If you're like, well, I'm a conscientious... No, the military is not there. I'm sorry for anybody who I offend with this, but I just don't care. The military is not there to be handicap accessible for you. All right? Yeah. If you had objection, like conscientious objection, because your religious views conflict with going to war, which is what the military of any nation is about, just save yourself an afternoon and don't go to the recruiter's office. Yeah.
I actually knew a conscientious objector.
Did he join first?
Yeah.
He should not have joined.
You know him too.
Oh, I do. Who?
I'm not saying names, just in case he watches.
We'll say names after the podcast.
Cool.
Yeah. He still believed in the military. He just didn't believe in what security forces was. So he switched to...
None of us believe what security forces is.
He switched to being, if I remember right, a helicopter maintainer. You know exactly who I'm talking about, too.
Still shouldn't be there.
We may do an episode on Desmond Doss because that's a great story.
I hope so.
If you guys have never seen Hacksaw Ridge,
oh, that's a great movie.
Go watch it. It will make you cry.
I cried.
All right, back to this loser.
Okay, so he, along with David Balsiger, co-authored The Satan Cellar, the book that catapulted Warnke to fame. The book, published in 1972, detailed Warnke's alleged descent into and escape from Satanism, making him a prominent figure in Christian circles during the height of the Satanic Panic of the 1980s. Despite later controversies and investigations that questioned the veracity of his claims, Warnke's stories captivated audiences and positioned him as a leading voice against what was perceived as the growing threat of occultism in America.
Honestly? Sounds like he probably was never into Satanism.
He wasn't. That's the whole point of this.
I bet you any money he just went to one really weird party at San Bernardino College and got freaked out by it.
He was never into Satanism. In 1972, Mike Warnke's book, The Satan Cellar, was released, propelling him to fame with the evangelical Christian community. Co-authored with David Balsiger and Les Jones, the book claimed to recount Warnke's harrowing journey from a troubled childhood into the dark world of Satanism. According to Warnke, he rose through the ranks to become a high priest, participating in orgies, drug dealing, and ritualistic activities that included casting spells, summoning demons, and engaging in ritual sex, including kidnapping and rape.
Again, sounds like a fairly typical frat party.
And listen, that shit isn't part... I'm not saying Satanism is perfect.
It's not.
Because it's not, but... That's not what they do. Yeah.
If they're doing it, they're doing it on their own.
Well, yeah, there's just like there's sects of other religions. I mean, you have people who claim to be Christians that are raping and doing all of that.
Yeah.
So, So there's actually a difference between the Satanism and the Church of Satan. They're two different things. The Church of Satan are just a bunch of people that want to be left alone and that's it. They don't do any occult stuff. They don't do anything like that. They just kind of want to be left alone and allowed to be included in the religious freedoms. But this whole thing, summoning demons, all of that stuff, he probably was in a freaking college orgy.
Probably he was tripping out on drugs.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think it was more the drugs than anything.
Well, he described a dramatic turning point in his life involving a near-fatal heroin overdose that left him delusioned with Satanism, followed by his transformation after finding Jesus during a service in Vietnam. This book concludes with Warnke happily settled in California with his wife, Sue Studer, positioning him as a redeemed sinner now dedicated to evangelism. Within 3 months of its release, The Satan Seller became a religious bestseller, making Warnke a celebrated figure in Christian circles.
Can I just throw up now?
Yeah.
Honestly, if that had actually been the end of my Warnke, he probably would have been, there would have been no issue to, in certain Christian circles, he would, his story would have been actually inspiring. But
he let the fame get to his head.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people do.
Yeah.
So, Warnke's newfound fame allowed him to become a highly sought-after speaker at Christian events and venues such as Melodyland in Anaheim, California, which doesn't exist anymore. His vivid and sensational accounts of life as a former satanic high priest captivated audiences, further enhancing his reputation as an authority on the dangers of occultism. In 1974, Warnke moved his family to Tulsa, Oklahoma to attend Trinity Bible College, which still exists. It's one of the biggest Bible colleges in the world. A 9-month program that served as a preparation for his ministry. And listen, if you went to Bible college, what are you doing with your life?
Are they actually accredited colleges?
Yes and no. I mean, you don't get a degree. You get a certification. I can do the same thing, and I did the same thing, going online and becoming ordained. It literally, you sit there for 9 months, they teach you how to read the Bible, and that's it.
I feel like if you can already read, you're about halfway there.
Yeah.
So this seems like a very long program.
Yeah. During this time, he became involved with an extramarital affair with Carolyn Alberti, reflecting the personal turbulence that would later be revisited in his public life. So, this born-again Christian, this great evangelist, going to Bible college, cheats on his fucking wife.
I just have one Christian leader who actually lives by the values he espouses.
No.
I can't even get one?
No.
Right. Actually, there are some.
I'm sure there are, but you know what?
That went to Moody. I believe he went to Moody Bible College. Name dropping. Pastor Al, if you are listening to this, I am very, very sorry. And please don't tell anyone.
While at Trinity Bible College, Warnke also met Elijah Cody, an independent bishop of the Syro-Chaldean Church. It's an Assyrian church of the East.
Oh.
Yeah. Who ordained him as a deacon. Yeah, so he's now an Assyrian pastor. Following his graduation, Warnke was ordained once more and relocated with his family to Denver, Colorado, where he continued his ministry. Warnke's rise to fame was characterized by a compelling narrative that resonated deeply with the evangelical community, particularly during the heightened fears of the Satanic Panic era. However, his growing influence was also marked by personal and professional contradictions that would eventually lead to scrutiny and controversy. Mike Warnke's rise to fame continued through the 70s with a combination of live recordings and controversial personal choices. In November 1975, his testimony about converting from Satanism to Christianity was incidentally recorded at a coffee house in Indiana, which became his first album, Alive. The album quickly gained traction on Christian radio, bolstering Warnke's reputation as a prominent Christian speaker and entertainer. However, later that year, Warnke left his first wife, Sue Studer, for Carolyn Alberti, despite interventions from pastors and other ministers. His divorce from Studer was finalized on December 1975, and 4 months later, he married Alberti. His personal life remained tumultuous, marked by continued relationship struggles and a pattern of infidelity. So this was a huge thing in the 70s, 80s, and 90s was pastors would record their sermons on CDs and sell them. Even the church I went to, you could buy before they started live streaming. They live stream it now. So, but before that, we would record it on the CD, and you could buy the CD of that sermon for like $10.
All proceeds to the church restoration fund.
All proceeds straight to the pastor's fucking pocket. Warnke's popularity soared as he released a series of comedy and storytelling albums, including Jester in the King's Court in 77 and Hey Doc in 78, which recounted his experiences in Vietnam. These albums solidified his status as a leading figure in Christian comedy, making them some of the most popular Christian comedy albums ever produced. During this period, while on tour in Hazard, Kentucky, not too far from us, Warnke met Rose Hall, a thrice-divorced mother of three. He began courting her while still married to Alberti, leading to a turbulent end to his second marriage. According to Alberti, the marriage ended violently when Warnke physically assaulted her, prompting her to flee to Florida. The couple divorced in November 1979, and Warnke soon moved to Hall's farm in Kentucky. He married Hall on January 2nd, 1980.
Oh, he just gets better and better.
How does he keep affording all of this?
CDs? I don't know.
Offerings and tithes?
Yeah, pretty much. He's a speaker.
Like I said, they go right to his fucking pocket. And I'll tell you, so the way it works, too, even to this day, is when, let's say, I'm sure you guys have been into a church that they bring a guest speaker in.
Yeah.
That guest speaker is paid to be there.
Yeah.
The offering you give up that day goes into that guest speaker's pocket. They are paid to be there. They're not there out of the kindness of their heart. They are there because they are paid to do it. We used to have Christian comedians come in all the time.
Oh, we had Gideon's Bible representative come in all the time.
What's Gideon's Bible?
You know the Bibles that you find in hotel rooms and stuff?
Oh, yeah.
That's Gideon's Bible.
It's a totally different version of the Bible.
Oh.
Throughout the 1980s, Warnke continued to produce albums, including A Christian's Perspective on Halloween, 1979, which he initially self-produced after a dispute with his label, World Records. Following their reconciliation, Warnke released several more albums under World's Dayspring label, including Coming Home in 1981, Higher Education in 1982, and Growing Up in 1983. Despite his growing success and the financial prosperity of his ministry, which raised millions of dollars annually, Warnke's personal relationships continued to falter. His marriage to Hall deteriorated, and the couple separated in 1989, with their divorce finalized in 1991. Just 6 weeks after this third divorce, Warnke married Susan Patton, a fellow alumna of Rim of the World High School, marking yet another chapter in his complex and often controversial personal life.
I'm surprised Hall didn't just kill him.
He literally cannot be alone.
No?
That's the sounds of it.
Sounds like my ex-wife.
He's pretty much a living example of why that Billy Graham rule about how Billy Graham would never be alone in a room. Married with a woman that's not his wife. He's probably the reason Billy Graham has that role, because he can't be alone with a woman.
It's not just Billy Graham. I mean, that was so being, I've talked about it before. I was a Pentecostal youth pastor, and that was a rule. I was married at that point, and if we went, and even when I wasn't married, if we went out, like I went out with my friends, there always had to be, it wasn't just allowed to be a guy and a girl. There always had to be another person there. Always. It was the rule that we had at that church.
I don't think we had that rule at my church, but if we did, I broke that a lot.
I just sounds like somebody was a little too afraid about getting frisky with the female congregations. I'm just saying, that's what that rule sounds like. It's like, okay, Pastor Bob's getting a little too handsy. And so we need to find a way to do that, but not in a way that we call out Pastor Bob.
Yeah.
Here we go. That's it.
They're afraid of hurting people's feelings.
Seriously.
Fuck people's feelings. If they don't care about yours, you shouldn't care about theirs.
I feel like I would either, if I hadn't married Pam, if I had been a priest, I'd either be the worst priest in the world or the best priest. Because I'd be, I just
can never imagine you being a priest.
I can't either. I would just show up on Sunday and like, listen, we all believe in God, right? Yes.
Fuck these hominies and hymns.
Football's starting now. Let's go.
Fuck these hominies and hymns.
I had some priests who would actually have fun with the homilies. Like, they actually were pretty, they're pretty charismatic and engaging, but,
Football Sunday with our church, second service, our path, if we went to second service, he always is like, all right, we need to speed through the music. I'm going to speed read my sermon so we can all get, home to watch the game because I'm not missing it.
Yeah. How do you think it is growing up in the South?
Worst part was when I went to my high school, St. Francis, our graduation night was in the middle of the Sabres playoffs, and our principal, Father Joe, Father Joe was the president of the school, Father Mike Syka, excuse me, I know I'm name dropping, but they're awesome people, so I don't care.
Plus, they probably don't listen to us anyway.
True.
They'd be ashamed of you.
Well, Father Joe would be ashamed of me for other reasons, not this. No, but they weren't really big sports fans, so that we begged them, like, please, Father Joe, can we just start earlier so we can get
so
home?
We can watch the Maple Leafs game.
First of all, go fuck. But Father Joe was like, no, it's the graduation. We're not doing it. And then, well, you know, someone may.
And this was before phones.
Somebody in my graduating class brought one of those little transistor battery-operated radios. And
again, before phones. When I graduated high school, I had a cell phone.
We didn't have that.
I had a smartphone when I graduated high school.
If any of my old classmates ever find us and listen, you'll know what we're talking about, where we were all just kind of leaning in into the middle of the thing so we could just listen to the game. And then just as Father Joe finished speaking, you hear Rick Jenneret, the famous announcer from the Sabres, go, score! Oh, go, he said, and then Father Joe and Father Mike just glared daggers at all of us.
So, in the early 1980s, Mike Warnke began to exaggerate his background and achievements, significantly embellishing his personal and professional history. Over the years, his claims of academic credentials expanded from holding two bachelor's degrees to possessing two master's degrees and eventually to a doctorate of philosophy.
He didn't go to school at all, by the way.
His accounts of military service also became increasingly inconsistent. In his book, The Satan Seller, he claimed to have been wounded twice in Vietnam, but by the time he published Hitchhiking on Hope Street, he was claiming five wounds. In 1983, Warnke was ordained as a bishop by independent bishop Richard Morrill, allowing him to adopt the title of bishop in addition to his other self-proclaimed accolades.
I don't think minor little cuts count as a wound.
I'd be interested to see his DD-214.
Yeah.
I wonder if I can put in the records request for that.
We could do it as a follow-up
request. We should. I'm gonna remind me to do that. I'm going to put in a records request to get his DD-214 because it'll tell exactly what he got, if he actually did get a Purple Heart, all of that stuff. And that's if it's not... Hell, that's if it's not in, like, on the internet already.
Yeah.
See,
this is one of the last times when people could actually make these claims, because back then you had to really know how to go looking for this information, because Joe Schmo, he's listened to this, he's gonna believe it, because why wouldn't he believe it?
Yeah, so I'll try and find his DD-214, and then we'll do a little follow-up and see if he actually did anything.
I mean, like, if Mark Warnke today was trying to make this claim in the age of Google and cell phones, he'd probably be making one. He'd say it, and literally 2 minutes later, they'd be like, you're lying.
Yeah. So, Warnke's national exposure peaked when he appeared on ABC's 2020 in May 16, 1985, in an episode titled The Devil Worshippers. During the program, Warnke was presented as an expert on Satanism, discussing the tools and attire used in satanic rituals, and even showcasing a scar that he claimed was from repeated cutting during ceremonies. His appearance on 2020 bolstered his reputation as an authority on the occult, leading to frequent collaborations with Christian radio host Bob Larson and the authors associated with Chick Publications, who often cited him in their works on Satanism. However, Warnke's credibility came under intense scrutiny in 1991 when Cornerstone Magazine launched an investigation into his life and claims. This followed the magazine's earlier investigation that had debunked the sensational claims of Lauren Stratford about her alleged involvement in satanic rituals. Cornerstone journalists Mike Hernstein and John Trott interviewed over 100 of Warnke's acquaintances and examined his ministry's financial records, uncovering numerous inconsistencies and evidence of deceit in Warnke's stories. Among the revelations were photographs from the period Warnke claimed to be a Satanist high priest, which instead showed him as a clean-cut young man typical of the 1960s, rather than the drug-addicted, long-haired occult figure he described. Furthermore, his assertions about attending rituals with Charles Manson were proven false, as Manson was in federal prison during the time of question.
Also, Manson was not a Satanist. No. Fucking cuckoo murdering bastard? Yes.
But he was never a Satanist. And never claimed to be.
Yeah.
Charles Manson had told more truths than this guy.
Which is saying something.
Yeah. The investigation also highlighted Warnke's involvement with Campus Crusade for Christ before his naval service, conflicting with his narrative of a descent into Satanism during that time. Despite efforts to interview Warnke, Cornerstone and Warnke could not agree on terms, and the magazine published its findings in June 1992 at the Christian Booksellers Association convention, effectively dismantling Warnke's fabricated persona and exposing the extravagant falsehoods that had propelled his rise to fame. After the publication of the Cornerstone's investigation in 1992, year I was born, how old were you, Ben?
Four.
I was most likely two or one.
Why do you do that?
Because it's funny. Mike Warnke issued a response insisting that his testimony of being delivered from Satanism through the power of Jesus Christ, as detailed in the Satan Cellar, was truthful. He claimed that some details were intentionally altered to protect the privacy of certain individuals and to prevent the book from being used as a guide for occult practices. Okay. However, Warnke did not provide any specific names of fellow Satanists and instead directed invectives against his ex-wife, Carolyn Alberti. In subsequent months, Warnke began to concede some inconsistencies, telling Christian Today that his coven had only 13 members rather than the 1,500 he initially claimed. And of those, five were unaccounted for while the rest had died.
Uh-huh.
So nobody to back up the claims. Public reaction to the expose was overwhelmingly negative towards Warnke. Initially, World Records expressed support for him, but further investigations by the Lexington Herald Leader exposed financial mismanagement within Warnke's ministry, revealing that Warnke, his ex-wife Rose, and her brother Neil Hall received a combined salary of $809,680 while the ministry claimed it was in financial need. And this was in the 80s?
That's about well over $1 million today.
What a fucking douchebag.
Very much so.
Or someone I know that's close to me. A douche canoe.
Let's see. So, in today, it would be, in 2024, it would be $3.2 million.
Damn.
Given inflation. It would be $3.2 million fucking dollars.
God damn.
Specifically, $3,235,430. But the ministry was in need. In response, World Records severed ties with Warnke, and on September 30th, 1992, less than 100 days after the investigation's release, Warnke's ministry was shut down. In the spring of 1993, Warnke submitted to an assembly of ministers acting as elders, admitting to his ungodliness, multiple divorces, personal failings, and embellishments in his storytelling. He offered to pay back taxes and agreed to several recommended changes for accountability, though he continued to affirm his claims of former satanic involvement. Warnke attempted to rebuild his life and career despite suffering a heart attack in 1997. By 2000, he began making a modest comeback, primarily speaking at small churches in Kentucky. In 2002, he published Friendly Fire, Recovery Guide for Believers Battered by Religion, where he portrayed himself as having been unfairly treated by the Christian community in the wake of the Cornerstone expose. By 2004, Warnke was occasionally performing at churches nationwide, often billed as Christian comedian Mike Warnke, and at times still referred to as former satanic priest. Despite the lingering impact of the scandal, Warnke persisted in his public engagements, continuing to navigate the complex legacy of his controversial past.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Just a shitty comedian who was able to
sweet talk his way back into the church.
I will say Cornerstone, as a primarily Christian publication, actually, he seems to have done their due diligence in actually exposing people for frauds, not just basically being a propaganda machine.
Yeah, he's still alive, lives in California.
Of course he does.
Supposedly, he's 77. But there's not much on him because I think he's just kind of tried to hide and disappear. But
at this point, he's probably just waiting for the Grim Reaper to get him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Leith Peter von Stein.
This one is a little more darker since this is an actual murder.
Yeah. So, believe it or not, contrary to the name, he is American. Leith Peter von Stein was an American businessman born on March 16, 1946, around when Ben was born.
Yep.
Whose brutal murder in 1988 became the focus of one of North Carolina's most high-profile criminal cases. On the night of July 25th, 1988, von Stein was attacked and killed in his home in Washington, North Carolina, while his wife, Bonnie von Stein, was also severely injured but survived. The investigation revealed that the crime was orchestrated by von Stein's stepson, Christopher Pritchard, along with two of his friends, James Bartlett Upchurch III and Gerald Neal Henderson. Motivated by greed and influenced by drugs, the group plotted to murder von Stein for his life insurance money and inheritance. The trial that followed captivated the nation, highlighting themes of betrayal, family, dysfunction, and the dangerous allure of easy wealth. The case gained widespread media attention and became the subject of two books, Blood Games by Jerry Bledsoe and Cruel Doubt by Joe McGinnis. Additionally, it inspired two television films, Honor Thy Mother and Cruel Doubt, which dramatized the chilling events and trial. The notoriety of the case was fueled by the sensational details of the planning and involvement of young college students in a violent crime that shattered the perceived safety of a quiet southern town. On the morning of July 25th, 1988, in the Smallwood subdivision of Washington, North Carolina, Leith von Stein and his wife Bonnie were brutally attacked in their bedroom by an intruder armed with a knife and a club. Leith sustained fatal injuries while Bonnie survived despite being severely wounded. Despite her injuries, Bonnie managed to summon help, leading to the discovery of the crime. The couple's attack sent shockwaves through the quiet community, as Leith was known as a successful businessman, and such violence seemed out of place in their suburban neighborhood. Leith von Stein was the stepfather to Bonnie's two children from a previous marriage, Christopher, commonly known as Chris, and Angela Pritchard. Angela, whose bedroom was located in another part of the house, claimed to have slept through the entire ordeal and was unharmed during the attack. At the time, Chris Pritchard was not living at home. He resided in a student dormitory at North Carolina State University, seemingly distancing himself from the immediate events of that tragic night.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. Unless he just didn't want to harm his baby sister.
Probably.
I mean, if he really was in it for the money, what's the point of harming? What's the point of killing his mother? And
well, so typical wills, him killing his stepfather, all that would go to his mom.
Depends on how the will's written.
Yeah.
If the will's written that the kids get it, then he gets it. But there's also no point in killing his sister because
she doesn't. Nothing happens. What's gonna happen?
They're both gonna get money. So
unless he didn't want her, unless he wanted all the money for himself.
The investigation into the murder revealed a dark and twisted plot that shocked those who knew the family. It was eventually uncovered that Chris Pritchard had conspired with his friends James Bartlett Upchurch III and Gerald Neil Henderson to murder his stepfather, driven by a desire to claim his inheritance and life insurance money. The crime and subsequent trial revealed a disturbing tale of betrayal, greed, and a cold, calculated plan that led to one of North Carolina's most notorious murder cases. The police investigation into the murder of Leith Von Stein initially focused on the immediate family, as it was discovered that Leith's estate was valued at $2 million. The substantial inheritance put Bonnie Von Stein and her children, Chris and Angela, under scrutiny as potential suspects. However, as the investigation progressed, attention increasingly centered on Chris Pritchard, whose behavior and connections raised red flags for the authorities. A significant breakthrough in the case came when Neil Henderson, a college friend of Chris Pritchard, confessed to his role in the crime. Henderson admitted to investigators that he had driven another friend, James Moog Upchurch, to and from the scene of the murder. According to Henderson, the entire plot was orchestrated by Pritchard, who had promised both Henderson and Upchurch a share of his expected inheritance if his mother and stepfather were killed. This revelation exposed a disturbing scheme fueled by greed, where Pritchard exploited his friend's loyalty and their desire for easy money. Nearly a year after the attack, in June 1989, Chris Pritchard, Neil Henderson, and James Upchurch were arrested and charged with the murder of Leith Von Stein and the attempted murder of Bonnie Von Stein. The case, marked by betrayal and manipulation, captivated public attention as the details of the plot unfolded, revealing the shocking extent to which Pritchard and his accomplices were willing to go for financial gain. The arrest of the three young men highlighted the tragic downfall of a seemingly promising group of college students who became embroiled in a deadly conspiracy. The trial of Chris Pritchard, Neil Henderson, and James Upchurch took place on January 1990, drawing significant public attention due to the shocking nature of the crime and the ages of those involved. Chris Pritchard, who confessed to masterminding the murder plot after his arrest, and Neil Henderson, who admitted to serving as Upchurch's lookout and getaway driver, both accepted plea deals in exchange for reduced charges. As part of their plea agreements, Pritchard and Henderson testified against James Upchurch, who maintained his innocence throughout the trial. Upchurch was ultimately found guilty of first-degree murder, assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill or seriously injure, conspiracy to commit murder, and burglary in the first degree. He was initially sentenced to death along with a multiple lengthy prison terms for the other charges. However, his death sentence was vacated in 1992, and he was resentenced to life imprisonment without the eligibility of parole until 2022, 2 years ago. So do you, for those listening at home, do you guys know the difference between breaking and entering and burglary?
I forgot.
So breaking and entering is simply breaking into an unoccupied dwelling. You add burglary when the dwelling is occupied.
That's right.
So it makes it go from a misdemeanor to a first degree felony in most states. Chris Pritchard was convicted of aiding and abetting in second degree murder and received a life sentence, along with an additional 20 year sentence for aiding and abetting the assault on his mother, Bonnie Von Stein. He was paroled on June 2nd, 2007, and later became a born again Christian. Neil Henderson was also convicted of aiding and abetting second-degree murder, as well as aiding and abetting assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill or seriously injure, for which he was sentenced to a total of 46 years in prison. He was paroled on December 11, 2000. The case, with its themes of betrayal and youth gone astray, and a chilling murder-for-hire scheme, left an indelible mark on the public consciousness. The Von Stein murder case became the subject of two books published in 1991, Cruel Doubt, again, by Joe McGinnis, and Blood Games by Jerry Bledsoe, both of which were adapted into television films. Bledsoe's book inspired Honor Thy Mother, which aired in April 1992, while McGinnis's work was adapted into a two-part miniseries titled Cruel Doubt, aired in May 1992. Both adaptations heavily emphasized the perpetrator's interest in the role-playing game Dungeons and Dragons. See, it all comes full circle, suggesting a link between their involvement with the game, drug use, and the murder. However, critics, including those at Kirkus Reviews, questioned the strength of this connection, pointing out that the alleged influence of D&D and on the crime seemed tenuous at best. Additionally, both television adaptations displayed altered D&D handbooks, implying a sinister influence that was not conclusively supported by the facts. The case was also featured in later true crime television documentaries, including Dark Temptations in 2014 and Blood Relatives in 2016, which further explored the complex and tragic narrative surrounding the Von Stein family.
Yeah, D&D made him do it. Never mind the $2 billion inheritance.
I just want to go kill somebody right now.
Or the drug. Drug issues.
And now we go to the Coalition for Violence and TV, Thomas Radecki.
All right. So, Thomas Radecki received his medical degree from Ohio State College of Medicine in 1973. Following his graduation, he completed his postgraduate education with residencies at Philadelphia General Hospital and the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, gaining experience in the medical field. Later in his career, Radecki pursued legal education, earning a Juris Doctor degree. He attended Oklahoma City University School of Law from 1995 to 1996 before completing his legal studies at the Southern Illinois University School of Law between 96 and 98. His combined medical and legal education provided a diverse professional background, allowing him to engage in both medical practice and legal matters.
So the dude was fucking smart as shit.
Oh yeah, he's a very, very smart man. Thomas Radecki's career as a medical professional began with his licensure to practice medicine in West Virginia from 77 to 79 and Kentucky. He gained notoriety in the 80s for his outspoken criticism of the role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons, which he claimed was a link to suicide and violent behavior among young people. In 1985, Radecki cited a fictitious letter from the novel Mazes and Monsters as evidence of the game's dangers, and by 1987, he was making public statements asserting that Dungeons & Dragons was directly causing individuals to harm themselves and others. He testified as an expert witness in the appeal of Darren Molitor, who had been convicted of murder and in at least 12 other cases involving the game. However, his testimony was consistently rejected by the courts.
I wonder why.
Yeah.
There is no link.
Radecki's professional claims were also scrutinized when it was revealed that his alleged faculty position at the University of Illinois College of Medicine was based solely on his status as clinical faculty, meaning he was accredited to practice at a teaching hospital, a designation that was removed in 1985. Despite this, Radecki continued to assert his faculty affiliation for years afterwards. In 1992, his medical license was revoked for a minimum of 5 years by the Illinois Department of Professional Regulation due to allegations of inappropriate sexual conduct with a female patient.
Oh, so a dirtbag.
Yeah. He resigned from his role at the National Coalition of Television Violence, which we've heard of before, and his efforts to have his license reinstated early were denied following complaints related to a surrogate parenting institute, a fertility clinic he operated. Radecki's medical license was eventually restored in 2002, and he completed his probation in 2008.
So a complete douchebag for messing with parenting shit.
Yeah.
Got it.
Throughout his career, Radecki had several influential positions, including research director for the Internal Coalition Against Violent, or International Coalition Against Violent Entertainment, where he co-authored a study on violence in films and served on the board of the Parents Music Resource Center. He advocated for using tramadol as an alternative to Suboxone in opioid addiction treatment. However, his career ended in disgrace when, in September 2012, he voluntarily surrendered his Pennsylvania medical license amid allegations of trading drugs for sex with patients. In 2013, Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane announced Radecki's arrest for overprescribing medication and engaging in unprofessional conduct through his program, Doctors and Lawyers for a Drug-Free Youth. In 2016, Radecki was sentenced to an 11 to 22 year prison term, and his request for a reduced sentence was denied in 2018 despite his claims of improperly introduced evidence and his age.
What the fuck?
Man, this guy really had a fall from grace. Mike Warnacki was bad. This guy's worse.
Yeah. He is something else.
Yeah. And this guy was like right up there with the oh god, we just did the last episode on her, the lady whose son,
mother.
Yeah, the mother. She, her and him were like right up there, like usually in the same. Same breath with talking about this as experts back then. And good lord,
by the way, that's Thomas Radecki.
Yeah, he does look like a fucking creeper.
Really does. Now we get into
wrap it up with coming kind of full circle with, we mentioned Pokemon in the very first episode, so we're gonna kind of wrap it up with Pokemon.
I wasn't allowed to watch the TV show, but the cards, play the games. Not because it was satanic. It was too violent.
I honestly believe
this coming from my bio parents who abused me. So
I after researching this, I really believe they really just invented this because all the parents just didn't want their kids collecting cards and talking about Pokemon. So they're just like, Satanism. That's the key.
Pretty much. So, the association of Pokemon with the Satanic Panic emerged in the late 1990s and early 2000s, fueled by concerns among some religious and conservative groups who viewed the franchise as promoting occultism, violence, and anti-Christian values. Pokemon, created by Satoshi Tajiri and launched in Japan in 1996, quickly became a global phenomenon with its video games, trading cards, animated series, and merchandise. The franchise's immense popularity among children and teens drew scrutiny, and soon, rumors and accusations began to circulate, suggesting that Pokemon was linked to satanic influences. And then Satoshi Tajiri actually created this for his children. It wasn't supposed to, he didn't think it was going to be this big. He created it for a game to play for his children, and it just blew up.
Bet you any money his kids were rowdy and rambunctious, so he designed a game that would keep them calm and focus on something.
Yeah. Critics of Pokemon argue that the game's themes of evolution, supernatural powers, and capturing creatures were contrary to Christian teachings. Some religious leaders claim that the concept of Pokemon evolving was a direct reference to the theory of evolution, which conflicted with the creationist view held by some Christians. This was compounded by the idea that the Pokemon could possess various supernatural abilities, which critics likened to occult practices such as casting spells or summoning entities. Additionally, the competitive nature of Pokemon battles, where creatures were pitted against each other, was sometimes interpreted as promoting violence and animal cruelty, albeit in a fantastical context. Accusations intensified when certain religious groups, media outlets, and internet rumors falsely suggested that the name Pokemon translated into pocket demons, or that some character names were linked to demonic figures. For example, the Pokemon Kadabra was controversially associated with Satanism due to its appearance, which included occult-like symbols such as a star on his forehead and the use of a spoon, which some interpreted as a symbol of psychic powers associated with the occult. These fears were amplified by various claims, such as the notion that Pokemon trading cards encouraged gambling, disobedience to authority, and a general detachment from Christian morals.
Is it Kadabra also really a psychic Pokemon?
It's the middle. It is the second and the third evolutionary tier of Abra. Yeah. And I can tell you right now.
Aren't they psychic?
Yes, they are psychic. Yes.
So, I mean, they got one thing right.
But yeah. The whole point is he's a magician.
Yeah. Also, let's just not...
Because it's, what, Abra, then Kadabra,
then Alakazam.
Alakazam, yeah.
Also, let's not gloss over the fact that Abra is fucking hard to catch, and it always pisses me off when I try and capture that damn thing.
That's okay. I caught one, and then the game...
Were you talking about Pokemon Go?
No.
Imagine how these people would be like with us having Pokemon Go on our phones now.
Well, the emulators that you can get on your phone for it. I had one. The game never saved.
Oh, that's a rookie mistake.
Yep.
Also, but now they are right. Also, there's all the gambling and disobedience to your authority. But then again, that's just gambling in general. So
yeah. For many religious groups that adhere to a literal interpretation of the Bible, particularly the Book of Genesis, the concept of evolution is seen as fundamentally conflicting with the creationist belief that God created all living things in their current forms. This belief holds that the theory of evolution, as proposed by Charles Darwin, undermines the biblical account of creation and promotes a naturalistic worldview that excludes divine intervention. Within this context, the concept of evolution in Pokemon, where creatures evolve into more powerful forms, was seen as promoting a worldview that contradicted Christian teachings, leading to concerns among religious communities. One primary concern was the portrayal of naturalistic evolution in Pokemon. The idea, again, that creatures could evolve into stronger and more advanced forms through natural processes was interpreted by critics as reinforcing the Darwinian evolution, suggesting that life forms can improve and change over time without the need for divine creation or guidance, which they can. We've seen it. Even as people, you adapt over time. Why do you think people in Africa are typically black? Because there's so much melanin, and they're exposed to the sun, and if they were all white, they would be sunburnt 24/7.
They would be like me, being a lobster the minute you step outside.
It is why people in Africa are darker. People in the Middle East are darker than we are because of we evolved.
I don't have that problem. I don't usually burn.
Fuck off.
I don't either.
Fuck you too. I can't step out of the house in the summer without at least SPF 50 on my skin.
It's not our fault that the sun hates you.
Yeah. This was particularly troubling for those who believed in the literal biblical account of creation, as, again, it was seen as directly challenging the belief that all species were created by God exactly as they are. Moreover, since Pokemon was highly popular among children, critics feared the game's portrayal of evolution could influence young minds, leading them to accept evolution as a scientific fact, and thus potentially causing them to question or reject creationist teachings. This concern was especially pronounced among parents and religious educators who were vigilant about the content their children were exposed to. So they were mad because it would let the children have an open mind instead of a closed mind of just what they want them to learn, basically.
They literally could have just said, they evolved because of the power of God. There you go. End of story.
I'm surprised nobody made a Christian Pokemon.
I'm surprised. How would they do it, though?
Very easily. I could make it right now.
Please don't.
I could literally, like the entire thing is Noah is finding these animals and taking them on the ark. So you are Noah taking them on the ark.
Did you just make Noah Professor Oak?
Yes. And and on the ark, they are evolving to adapt to this new world from it being wiped out by floods. Boom, I just made that up in 5 minutes.
Wait, evolve.
Yes, but by the power of God, they can, because they need to be changed into this. So I'm surprised nobody's done it.
Probably because most of the people involved in this have no imagination, and they've probably
like, we're a fucking cuckoo.
You know what? Honest, my opinion, I don't think these people are crazy. I think these people have invested so much of their reputation, time, and financial assets into this basically thought process and this interpretation of everything that they have almost no choice but to just basically double and triple down on this, because if not, I mean, what else do they have? I mean, going back to earlier, Mike Warnacki, he even in the face of losing everything, he just kept doubling, tripling down, because what did he, if he admits everything, I was bullshitting y'all, he loses everything.
Yeah. Beyond the basic concept of evolution, some religious critics saw deeper, more troubling implications in the game's themes. The metaphorical transformation of Pokemon through evolution was sometimes interpreted as a symbol of self-improvement or transformation through one's own efforts, which could be seen as conflicting with Christian teachings that emphasize transformation through divine intervention, grace, and a faith in God, meaning that you cannot rely on yourself, you must rely on God. Just fucking idiotic. These radical Christians want to tell you that you are nothing without God, and without him, you will always be nothing. You were nothing before him. And you can't become a better person without having God in your life.
I'm just glad a lot of these people live out in the back of the woods where nobody has to interact with them except the bears.
Like, near us.
Again.
We are in the heart of the Bible Belt.
Yeah, but these guys are like deep in the woods where they don't bother anyone but themselves.
In extreme cases, the evolution of Pokemon was even equated with demonic transformation or possession. The idea that a creature could change into something more formidable was likened to the notion of a human being overtaken by a demonic force, gaining unnatural powers. This interpretation was rooted in fears that the game's themes could subtly introduce children to ideas of occultism and self-empowerment outside the realm of Christian beliefs, thus sowing seeds of spiritual confusion or rebellion against traditional religious teachings. So they're talking about these animals' abilities to control elements and stuff like that. Again, so is that not in the Bible as well? Do humans not control elements in the Bible? Noah literally parted a sea.
That was Moses.
Well, yes, Moses, whatever. He literally parted a sea. You had a burning bush that was talking.
I think I don't defend what they said, but from their view, Moses himself didn't part the sea. Moses was the instrument of God who, in fact, parted the Red Sea. That's how probably they interpreted it. You know what? Arguing with people like these is probably the most losing thing you can do. You probably get more accomplished by bashing your head in against a brick wall than anything. Because as I said before, these people have made these views their whole lives that they will never abandon it. Simply for the fact is, if they do abandon it, they probably feel, what else have they got? Which is about nothing.
The concerns about evolution in Pokemon led to a variety of public responses, particularly within religious communities that viewed the franchise's themes as conflicting with their teachings. One of the most direct responses was the implementation of bans and restrictions on Pokemon cards, games, and merchandise in some religious schools and communities. These measures were taken to prevent children from being exposed to the concept of evolution, which was seen as contradictory to the creationist beliefs held by these groups. By removing access to Pokemon, religious leaders and parents aimed to shield their children from ideas they felt could undermine their faith and worldview. In addition to outright bans, some religious educators took a different approach by using Pokemon as an opportunity to discuss the differences between Darwinian evolution and creationist beliefs. This involved framing the evolution seen in Pokemon as purely fictional and part of the game, rather than a reflection of scientific or spiritual reality.
These people really think that Pokemon was... people who made Pokemon really thought that was true?
Probably. Educators would sometimes highlight why the game's portrayal of evolution should not be taken seriously, reinforcing the distinction between entertainment and religious teachings. Furthermore, various religious leaders and organizations issued public statements or published articles criticizing Pokemon for promoting evolution, among other perceived issues like occultism or violence. These criticisms were often part of broader campaigns against secular influences in popular culture, reflecting a concern about the erosion of religious values in media consumed by children. The introduction of Dark-type Pokemon in the second-generation games, Pokemon Gold and Silver,
they're paid to fight,
sparked additional criticism from religious groups already wary of the franchise. The term Dark-type itself raised concerns as it was perceived as promoting themes of darkness or evil. This perception was amplified by the fact that the Dark-type Pokemon often had abilities or moves associated with trickery, stealth, and shadowy themes, which critics argued could expose children to negative influences. Moves like Nightshade, Curse, and Dark Pulse were interpreted as promoting occult or malevolent powers, further intensifying fears that Pokemon was leading children towards an interest in darker, sinister concepts.
I will say that Nightshade move in Pokemon is a bitch to fight to
get. Or, how about the Dark type are just creatures that thrive in the dark? The bats?
Actually, believe it or not, the Zubat, Golbat, and Crobat were not considered, at least at the time when I had Gold and Silver games, they were not considered Dark-type Pokemon. I'm sure they are now. They're the Pokemon universe is being always being redone.
You had... Oh, there's so many.
Okay. Hopefully this doesn't blur. If this blurs, I am sorry.
But this is where you had Umbreon.
I loved Umbreon.
Houndour.
I fucking
Houndoom.
I hated those Pokemon. I could never beat them.
Mightyena. Drapion.
This last half of the podcast episode is just going to basically be bitching about how I could beat a certain Pokemon. Just heads up, everybody.
But yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know.
I'm trying to pull it up.
Ghost-type Pokemon also became a focal point of concern due to their association with spirits, ghosts, and the afterlife. Pokemon such as Gastly, Haunter, and Gengar were seen as problematic because they appeared to desensitize children to death or promote belief in ghosts and the supernatural. They're real people.
Zubat is not considered dark.
I know, that's what I said.
Poison and flying.
Yeah. The eerie or malevolent designs of these Pokemon, often featuring grim or unsettling appearances, were viewed as promoting a fascination with the macabre, which critics argued was inappropriate for young audiences. These associations fed into broader fears that Pokemon was normalizing or glamorizing themes that contradicted traditional religious teachings about life, death, and the spiritual realm.
I always saw, every interpretation I saw of those three Pokemon was always goofy.
Yeah.
It was never really sinister. If they scared you, it was meant to be like that Disney type of boo.
It's Casper not, the Friendly Ghost.
Yeah, they're not malevolent.
You need to watch that for Halloween.
What?
Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Eh. Jinx, an ice psychic type Pokemon, attracted controversy for multiple reasons, including its unsettling humanoid appearance and perceived connections to occult themes. While Jinx was initially criticized for racial insensitivity due to its dark skin and exaggerated features, some critics also saw the character as embodying an occult figure due to its psychic powers. Similar to the criticisms of Kadabra, Jinx's psychic abilities were linked to accusations of promoting occult practices, reinforcing the belief that Pokemon was introducing children to supernatural concepts outside the bounds of Christian doctrine. Beyond specific Pokemon, the broader concept of the Pokemon world was criticized for various reasons tied to religious beliefs. The central mechanic of evolution was interpreted as a direct contradiction to creationist views, as it was seen as promoting the idea that creatures could change and evolve through natural processes rather than divine creation, like we said before. Some even extended this interpretation to suggest that Pokemon evolution resembled spiritual or demonic transformations. The act of capturing and training Pokemon, viewed by some as monsters, was sometimes likened to occult practices involving the collection or summoning of spirits or demons, raising fears that children might be drawn to similar real-life interests. Here's the funny thing. So, you want to talk about a contradiction. Christianity. They tell you spirits and ghosts don't exist.
Yep.
But then they believe that the occultists can summon spirits that don't exist.
Yep.
So, get your fucking story straight.
Are demons evil spirits?
I mean, some, if you, depends on the Christian. Some,
well, I'm just saying, like, what
some Christians believe in demons, but they don't believe that demons walk the earth.
Well, it's not that. Some Christians believe that demons aren't spirits, that they're physical beings.
That too.
Which contradicts itself, because if they're physical beings, that means I can punch them.
Some people believe
how are you getting possessed by a physical entity?
But, like, if you've ever read the book 23 Minutes in Hell, or 13 Minutes in Hell, something like that. It's the story of a guy who died, or basically God killed him so he could go to hell, so he could experience what it was like. And he explains what it felt like to, he was impaled by a demon. He said the demon was 13 feet tall and had long claws and walked into the jail cell that he was in and impaled him and lifted him up. And it's a, like, I was forced to read that as a kid.
What the fuck?
And it was a scary fucking book.
How many nights did you not sleep because of that book?
A lot. Additionally, some symbols associated with Pokemon battles, such as the rings or circles that appear during a battle when capturing a Pokemon, were occasionally linked to magic circles used in occult rituals or summoning.
Okay. That, soccer has, circles, baseball, magic. Football. No, football is actually the only one that does not have circles.
Correct. Football is a cult.
These visual elements meant to represent gameplay mechanics were misconstrued by critics as having deeper, more sinister connotations, further feeding into the narrative that Pokemon was subtly promoting occultism and pagan beliefs. This constellation of concerns reflected a broader unease with the secular and fantastical elements of Pokemon, underscoring the cultural tensions between popular entertainment and religious values during the period of the Satanic Panic. Now, we're going to kind of wrap this up, but I'm going to give you my wholehearted belief from somebody who experienced all of this. If you are a Christian that's listening to us, listen, we don't hate you by any means. You are allowed to practice what you want. Just don't shove it down somebody's throat. But listen, if you have children, please do not force them into Christianity or any religion, because what's going to happen is exactly what happened to me. Growing up, all the way till I turned 18 and moved out and joined the military, I was forced to go to church. I was forced to do this. I was forced to do that. And it left this little seed in the back of my head, even though I maintained Christianity up until 4 years ago, it left a seed in the back of your head going, okay, I don't like this. I don't like being forced to do this. Why am I being forced to do this? If this truly is a loving religion, why am I being forced here instead of being welcomed by making my own choice to do this? And that's the thing. So, and you hear paganism all the time, and essentially paganism is just any religion that's outside of the three major religions, so Christianity, Catholicism, and I believe it's Judaism is the three main ones. And then anything outside that is considered a pagan religion. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a polytheistic religion, because Buddhism isn't polytheistic. It's monotheistic, but it is still considered a pagan religion because it's outside of those main three. Now, of course, the main three are monotheistic, but I will tell you from my personal experiences, and everybody's experience is different. I personally myself felt more condemnation got walking into a Christian church with tattoos. And at the time, my ears were pierced and all of that stuff. And I felt more condemnation from that. I felt condemnation when my ex-wife cheated on me with a deacon in that church. I was looked at like I was a problem, even though I had done nothing. I was asked to step down from ministry, even though I had done nothing, because that deacon was the pastor's best friend. And then I have felt more welcoming becoming a pagan and being in this belief system. There's such a support system in this. And I'm not saying all Christians are that way, but 90% of Christians are the most judgmental people you'll find, especially when you get into the South, like I was raised. They're judgmental. If you don't follow their way of belief, then you're a horrible person and you're going to hell. I mean, when I came out to my family, I was no longer Christian. I literally had them message me and say, "Oh, I'll pray for you because I don't want to see you in hell." And that's not something you say to anybody, let alone your family. And that's the reason I don't talk to my family. I talk to my mother and my stepfather, and that's it, because they were surprisingly accepting of it. But there's this negative connotation of paganism that we all are doing black magic and that we're putting curses on people. And I'm not saying we don't do magic, because we do, but it's not what you think. We're honoring the world. We're honoring the earth, this place that most people have taken for granted and are destroying. We are trying to save it and give back to it and honor it and the place that we come from. And yes, we have different beliefs, but at the end, we're all human. We all bleed the same color. We all are in the same world, that if we continue this hatred of other religions, just like you have the twisted forms of various religions. That, I mean, there's Norse paganism is associated with being racist because of the Nazis and white supremacists. And unfortunately, that's just
like Mjolnir is considered a racist symbol.
Well, and even the swastika, the swastika was originally a Hindu symbol that represented life and prosperity that Hitler took and turned it on its head. Same thing with the lightning bolts, the SS bolts that we see. Those are actually Norse runes that were taken. And unfortunately, we can't use those. I can't tattoo those on my body if I want to, because I would be seen as a Nazi. And so the bottom line for me is that please keep an open mind to any religion. Don't force your children into believing something. Like for me, if my kids want to be Christian, they can be Christian. I'm okay with that if that's what they want. That's not for me. It's not for me anymore. I won't ever go back to being a Christian again, just because I have more questions than answers. And I found more answers in finding myself in paganism. But if you want to be a Christian, it's just like Ben's Catholic. We have no issues with that.
No.
We may make fun of our religions just because that's just who we are, but we will never hate on somebody for being part of another religion. And I think this whole satanic panic and hating people because they play D&D or they do this, they do that, like, it has no correlation with each other. I know plenty of churches that play D&D in their youth groups, and it's a way to bring people together, but that correlation just, it's so bad, and I hope we never go back to this point in history.
So, I was going to say something. I really feel like the whole, the satanic panic, this is, it really kind of, to me, gets boiled down to this. People, I think, are fundamentally naive, and they don't want to face the world. What is, you know, they, everyone looks for the boogeyman. We look for the devil. We look for whatever entity we can find that we can say, we can point to and say, yes, that's the bad guy. And it is, I hope everyone who's been listening can kind of see what I hope that I've been seeing. The devil is in the details, to quote the turn of phrase. You know, what the, our first thing about Mazes and Monsters, the poor young man who they initially tried to link his death to D&D and how it propelled his spiral, his mental instability and spiral downwards. You know, completely glossing over the fact that this was probably a very gifted but troubled young man who was pushed into a position he was not ready for. No support about who he was as a person. Probably very conflicted himself about who he was as a person. But no, D&D is the problem. The Patricia, what was it her name? I forget. I have to go. I'll go back. But the person, the mother who started the mother's aggravated against D&D.
Yeah.
She looked to D&D and Satanism as blaming for the fact of the death of her child and all these other things. Never mind the fact that she just, unfortunately, she didn't see the problems in her son and was too late to act to save him. Or at least try. Maybe if she did, he still ultimately killed himself. We'll never know. But people were like, yes, that the devil in D&D made her son kill himself. Ignoring the fact that that children, mental illness and instability are very rampant in children. We don't like to think about that because children aren't supposed to have those problems in a perfect ideal world, but we don't live in a perfect ideal world. So instead of actually addressing mental issues in children when they're young, when there is, you know, in theory, a chance to help them, we ignore them, tell them to grow up and be normal, and, you know, just stop doing weird stuff.
Yeah.
And also we look at crime. We see brutal murder, and what do? We see people trying to, like, oh, that D&D, that made them all, or Pokemon or whatever, caused them to go to a normal person to go and kill somebody. It's like, no. Greed, malicious intent, anger, jealousy. These are the things that make humans flawed. But nobody wants to face that. We would rather try and find the boogeyman. And unfortunately, they seem to deter, people are determined, and I like, and from what I've seen, I don't think it is as prevalent anymore, because I think people are more aware these days than they were 30 years ago, that there is no boogeyman. Not really. To quote a little thing from that movie Footloose, the devil isn't in books. It's in here, pointing to your chest and heart. The devil's in all of us. That's how I feel about it. I feel like this was, the satanic panic was just one big long denial of the fact that people are flawed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, with that, we want to thank you for visiting the Scarlet Tavern. Remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.